Welcome to the Big Picture Long Term audio for and video for the various different asset classes. Today is Friday, and it is November 18th, and we are in a rather sort of an inter regnum period because we've just had the U.S. election, and then we have a referendum in Italy in just a couple of weeks. Then there is on the same day on December 4th there is the Austrian presidential election, although that is only for a nominal position. And then of course there is the Republican primaries in France this Sunday, and that is happening against a background where the dollar has been very strong, and it has been up on consecutive days, and that is something that is rather stands out in terms of market performance, because it hasn't done that in years, that it has gone up on so many consecutive days. And we can only look at that and say then there is a it obviously is going up for a reason, but there is a short-term overbought condition, and there is the prospect of some consolidation, and then that could offer entry opportunities overall, because there are certainly investment opportunities resulting from a stronger dollar overall. But something that I want to talk about today is the discount rate. There has been a lot of research, and there has been a lot of terms coined over the last decade, which are akin to the new normal, lower for longer, and that type of way of thinking about markets. And people have been investing along those lines, and they've been making money, and there is nothing like making money to confirm your bias. And of course, there is then also career risk with questioning it. If your strategy has been working and you've been making money from it, then obviously you're going to underperform if you preempt its ending. And therefore, that is exactly what we're seeing in the bond markets. And I think if we look at some of the just the base rates from various central banks around the world, we can see a trend that they have either been contracting over the last year or they have been dead steady. And for the majority of the G7, interest rates are in the region of 0 to half of 1%. And even the UK, after the Brexit vote, brought the rate back down to just 25 basis points. The Bank of Japan is only 10 basis points. Brazil, on the other hand, is more like 14% overall. And then you can also see why there would be that represents just a fundamental tailwind for the Brazilian currency overall. And despite the fact that it did get a bit overcooked in the short term, and that there is a process of mean reversion underway, then there is, there are quite clear differences between the performance of the G7 currencies relative to each other, and then their performance relative to some of the very high-yielding emerging markets. Of course, those high-yielding emerging markets have high yields for a reason, and that means that they are more volatile overall. But what it also means is that the further they decline, the greater the incentive is to participate once more. So it has been a rather difficult environment overall for emerging markets. And that is because the dollar has been so very firm. But one of the perhaps the most important points overall is that this lower for longer, and betting on the continuation of very low interest rates indefinitely is now being questioned. But it has only been questioned in a certain number of circles, and ours would certainly be one of them. Because if we look at 12-month yields, then they're at about 75 basis points now. So they have priced in the almost virtual certainty that there is going to be a rate hike in December from the Federal Reserve. But these are 12-month yields, and that is the view on yields out to November of next year. And does anybody listening to this audio really think that there isn't going to be any other rate hike between now and December of next year? Personally, I think that that is really rather unlikely, considering that we are moving out of a very low interest rate environment overall. And that is a significant change. That is something that we have been engaged in for 6 or 7 years already. So when we think about the big picture long term, then we have to begin to think about interest rates as going up. And that isn't something that we have seen, and it has been a money losing strategy to bet on for quite some time. And yet, what we are definitely seeing is that producer prices are rising. And that is certainly happening in China. And what we have is that there is certainly, and I'm failing to find the ticker for that. I know we definitely have it, but producer prices have been rising just about all year. They broke out to new highs just in the last couple of months. That US earnings have been rising, and that is symptomatic of people not quitting their jobs, but are sorry, not being fired from their jobs, but choosing to leave or asking for more money. And that wage growth is up to 2.8%. It broke out last year, and the Fed raised interest rates. It's broken out again, so now it is very likely the Fed is going to raise interest rates again. And if Chinese producer prices are rising and wages are already increasing, well, then we have evidence that inflation is beginning to come back. We've also seen that commodities have staged a very impressive rally already this year. And there is certainly an argument that if China can export a deflation, then it can begin to export inflation. And that is a very important consideration. Now, if inflation was already on the way back, and now we're moving into the potential for a fiscal stimulus, there is an increasing perspective that quantitative easing isn't particularly effective at generating growth. The growth that it does, that it is very successful in achieving, is asset price inflation. But that has a disproportionately beneficial advantage on those that hold assets, and those that do not have assets, in fact, just see their living standards decrease because the price of everything that they have to spend money on, not least education and healthcare, it goes up. And I suspect that more than any other factor, that that is what is driving the rise of populism in North America, in the UK, and in Europe. And the only way that that is going to be, that the rise of populism can be blunted, is fiscal stimulus, because by definition it is more broad based. But the reality is that if we are engaging in fiscal stimulus in an expansion, in an economic expansion that has been going on since really the beginning of 2009, well then, and we already have evidence that inflation is beginning to reappear, then a fiscal stimulus at this stage of the cycle is likely to be outright inflationary. And then that the status quo, just the belief that that interest rates are going to stay low indefinitely, that the discount rate is so close to zero that just about any risk can be justified. That is also being brought into question. And it is most particularly a problem for the bond market. When we look at the US 10-year, then we are treated to one of the greatest bull markets in history. And I really do believe that it is worth looking at that on a log scale, because it highlights just how volatile those yields have become over the last 4 years. But what we have is this generational long contraction in government bond yields. And I turned 40 2 weeks ago, and I don't remember a time in my working life that yields have really been going up for any kind of sustained period of time. In fact, you'd have to have been in the markets for almost 40 years to have any experience of an inflationary period, and probably a bit more than that to have had any real experience before the inflation took off. So there is no institutional memory of inflation overall. And that is a very important point. I remember I was at a Double Line conference where Jeff Gundlach was talking last summer, and I was chatting with one of their marketing chaps in the reception afterwards, and I said, the thing that I look at is the Merrill Lynch Total Return Index, and one of the things that that really stuck in my head was his response to that, and he said, "Well, I wonder could that ever go down because of the way it's calculated." And I thought that was very telling. There is no such thing as a market that cannot go down. And this index is now trading back below the 200-day moving average. And this is not the first time that it has traded below the moving average. But it is one of the few times that it has done so. And the last time was during the taper tantrum of last year. Now, if you've been conditioned by a bull market and you believe that the index cannot fall because the total return on bonds is such that the higher yield will compensate you eventually for the drop in price, and that all you have to do is keep buying the dips and everything will be okay. And you have 30 years of experience, so not only have you got personal experience of it, but your boss probably has personal experience and will tell you to buy the dips. There were a number of articles to that effect in the last week. And it has to stop working in order for a top to be confirmed. So if people do buy the dip, then this index would have to encounter resistance in the region of the trend mean. And in fact, it did do that. It did that back in 2013, but it did not move to a new low. And that is what we need to see. So, it has been a 35-year bull market. Nobody has made any money by predicting that it is going to end. But we know that it will end. The ingredients are falling into place for this to be a much less than benign environment for bonds overall if inflation picks up. And there is a very strong likelihood that inflation will surprise on the upside. And that is a very easy forecast, because how could it not surprise on the upside? Because there has been absolutely no inflation priced in whatsoever. So therefore, any inflation at all will surprise on the upside. Then that is going to be potentially problematic for bond funds. Bond funds have to manage their duration. They are constantly buying and selling bonds. And in a falling market, it means that they might be capturing more yield, but that they are taking capital losses on their rolls. And that is really a potential problem overall. And considering that there are some very, very large bond funds, and they are passive strategies. And if you look at some of the very largest bond funds, there are individual bond funds that manage in the region of $2 and even $3 billion. And you start adding all of that up in passive strategies, there are tens of billions of dollars managed in bond funds. And because those are passive strategies, passive strategies work fantastically well in a trending environment. And this has been a remarkably trending environment. So there has been a very strong move into passive strategies overall. But nothing lasts forever. And generals are always fighting the last war. So it is very questionable if this is indeed a major peak in bonds. And considering that we are already at zero interest rates and that negative interest rates have been roundly accepted, that they simply don't work, well, then how much lower can yields really go? Because it is the most inherent contradiction in any market, that you can pay somebody to take your money and expect less of it back and still make a profit. I mean, that makes absolutely no sense. And yet, that is exactly what we saw when when this index was trading at its peak. And therefore, if inflation is almost, it can't but surprise on the upside, then bonds are going to really look like a terrible investment. Well, if that's a terrible investment, what is it that is likely to do best? Well, stocks and property generally do better in an inflationary environment overall. Because if you have inflation, then shares, the companies get to raise their prices. They have a very good reason for raising their prices because they say you have inflation. It's also a great opportunity to improve your margins. We've been through an earnings recession for a lot of major corporations, and that contributed to the underperformance of the index for really the last couple of years. But the question is now, is it over? Is the prospect of fiscal stimulus really going to help to drive these markets higher? Now, the S&P 500 isn't quite at a new high. The Dow Jones is. The Dow Jones broke out to new highs just this week. And of course, what is it that characterizes the Dow Jones relative to the S&P 500? It is very large, well-established businesses overall. So if then we're looking at the kinds of companies that can really compete, then what we're really looking for is companies that have the ability to raise their dividends. And when we look at those, then there is certainly the potential that it is going to be the dividend aristocrats overall that tend to outperform. So, when we look at, for example, the high yield dividend aristocrats from the S&P 500, they've been raising dividends for over 25 years. It still has one of the more consistent trends overall. And it has been practically denuded of bank shares. And realistically, if we look at the US banking sector, then what we are presented with is a long number of, and I really do need to look at these not just on a 10-year basis, but on a 20-year basis. Because then we get a really good indication of just how long the they have really done so very badly. That it isn't really fair to look at Wells Fargo, and despite the fact that it has largely got a get out of jail free card by virtue of what has been going on and the prospect of deregulation following what has been a rather tawdry affair in terms of its internal governance, it has now broken its almost year-long progression of lower rally highs. But then, and I'm looking at this list, and it is the types of companies that are not particularly in term not overly were not overly involved in the credit crisis that have done best, or their financials rather than actual banks. But if we look at the actual banks, then they have all broken out in the last year. Sorry, in the last week. And you can see, for example, JP Morgan hit a peak in 2000, retested that peak in 2015, and is now breaking on the upside. Goldman Sachs is at the upper side of an almost 10-year long range. JP Morgan is testing the upper side of an almost 10-year long base. And then it is in these types of companies that we see the potential for both higher interest rates to improve their margins, for bases that have been completed, deregulation to open up new business models. And there is a good reason that a lot of people were burned in the banking sector during the credit crisis, is because they generally did represent large positions in a lot of people's portfolios because they had such good records of paying dividends. And of course, the reason they could pay dividends is because they were making margins on their business. They haven't been able to make margins on their business because interest rates have been close to zero. There is the very real prospect that if margins are increasing and deregulation kicks in, that they'll be able to start paying dividends again. And in an inflationary environment, that even bolsters their attractiveness even more. But perhaps even more important than that is that banks fulfill a liquidity providing function within the economy. And they have been unable to fulfill that function for much of the last decade. They've had to hoard, they've had to ho have to hoard Tier 1 capital. They haven't really been able to lend out. There was a statistic just in the last few months that for the first time, the US banking sector is not the largest provider of mortgages, that private mortgage lenders have taken over that role. And they've taken over that role because they've been able to step in into a market that desired credit and where banks were unable to provide it. If the banking sector is moving back into a position of outperformance, then that is genuinely a very positive outcome overall for the wider economy. And we can see that there is an enormous sense of commonality just right across the sector. And generally speaking, that is really very positive indeed. You can see like Bank of America is breaking out of a really well-defined range, and it is certainly not the only one. So when we start to think about that, and something that we have looked at for a very long time has been the outperformance of the banking sector, and that does appear to now be taking place. Now, the Asia Dollar Index broke to a new low this week. Of course, what we are definitely seeing is that the strength of the US dollar is acting as a headwind for emerging markets. And of course, it's a headwind because there has been this very tight spread between developed markets and emerging markets. And I think that's a very general term. But because the dollar is strong, because there is a prospect for that interest rate differential to tighten, and because you have a strong dollar, you have a strong current and a strong capital market that has been attracting flows back into the US. And if it's coming back to the US, it's flowing out of somewhere else. So the spread that is required on emerging markets is widening. And that is putting downward pressure on those currencies. But of course, what it is also doing is improving their competitiveness. So spreads are widening and competitiveness is improving. And therefore, emerging markets are likely to benefit because if we do have growth coming through from fiscal stimulus, not just in the US but elsewhere, then demand for the types of exports that emerging markets produce is likely to increase. Their competitiveness will improve, will have improved because their currencies have gone down. And then that will create the conditions for them to move back into a position of outperformance, or that they will fulfill their sort of classic leverage to global growth. We've been through a period of fiscal, oh, sorry, of synchronized global monetary expansion, and it hasn't been ideal. There is an increasing likelihood that we are moving into a synchronized period of fiscal expansion. It's being led by the USA. Certainly, Japan is rowing in behind that. And there is the very real prospect that the rise of populism in Europe is going to break the fiscal tightening regime that has really put a lid on Eurozone growth for the last decade. And there is a simple reason for that. There is absolutely no way they can hold the euro together if you have restive populations continuing to propose status quo breaking candidates for election. Because it is really only a matter of time before one of the big Eurozone countries that are central to the Eurozone project elects a Eurosceptic government. And then what do you do? One thing that we can be reasonably assured of is that the euro is very much in Germany's interests. If it weren't for the euro, the Deutsche Mark would be substantially stronger, that the German export sector would be in dire straits, and therefore Germany needs the euro. But everywhere else, and particularly on the periphery, really desires a weaker currency overall. What they really need is a concerted fiscal stimulus to re-engage with growth, to bring down record high employment, to give entire generations of young people a path to prosperity. And if they can achieve that, then the likelihood of the euro surviving will improve. And without it, the likelihood of the euro breaking up and creating a very big problem for Europe overall will become the base case. And therefore, bureaucrats will almost always vote for the outcome that ensures their survival. So the prospect of synchronized global fiscal expansion has got to be the base case. We are 8 years into an expansion, or well, almost 8 years into an expansion. This is obviously not early in the cycle. If we get fiscal stimulus, then that is an additional flow of liquidity into this market, and we get an additional leg higher. If earnings improve, then PE ratios, expansion will be somewhat contained, and then the market can go higher again. But if this is occurring in an environment where interest rates are rising, then interest rates rising initially is generally speaking on the back of enthusiasm about potential growth. But the higher interest rates go, the greater the headwind that they represent, and that will eventually ask big questions about the sustainability of the additional debt and deficits that go to fund the fiscal stimulus. And there is a great deal of debt needs to be rolled over in the period between 2018 and 2021. And that it represents a significant question about at what rate that debt is going to be rolled over. There is a long-term question about the sustainability of the size of central bank balance sheets, and considering that it is artificially high because one arm of the government has been lending to the other, there is the potential that they simply buy up all of the issues of one particular tranche and then cancel it. So, we do have certain outcomes, but we are in an environment where there are extraordinary monetary measures being proposed and enacted on a relatively frequent basis, so nothing can be ruled out. We can only look at what is the potential outcome. Now, what are the three main bullish factors that are likely to drive the growth beyond these monetary conditions and monetary I think arguments are that the pace of technological innovation is continues to advance, and that is largely independent of what happens with central banks. Moore's Law has been applied to an increasing number of sectors, and they don't all double at in 18 months, just like semiconductors have been doing for a long time. Battery technology doubles about once every 5.3 years. So that is relatively small. Electric car ownership is doubling almost every year. And when numbers are very small, it doesn't generally tend to have a very big impact. But if it continues, then the global car fleet will be about 10% electric within the next 5 years. And that will have a meaningful effect on oil. Oil prices are likely to range rather than trend, and the potential for additional upside is rather short term in nature. Oil prices right now are at the lower side of their range, so there is potential for steadying. But there are medium-term challenges that are not simply going to be overcome, and that there really is a rush on to capture market share. That's as true of Saudi Arabia as it is of Canada, and it is also why OPEC is finding such great difficulty in coming to an agreement, because they can see the writing on the wall. There is a very clear reason why Saudi Arabia and SoftBank have created a $100 billion fund to invest in technology, because Saudi Arabia absolutely knows that it has to diversify if it has any chance at all of maintaining the standard of living that its population have become rather used to. And that is an example of at least a beginning of planning ahead. There is the fact that technological innovation is improving at such a rapid rate that emerging markets more than ever have to be inventive and have to have improving standards of governance if they are going to succeed, because automation is occurring at such a rapid rate that the low-cost manufacturing growth model that helped to fund growth and infrastructure development is likely a thing of the past, that it will not be possible to do that 30, 40 years from now. So emerging markets that are going to develop need to be doing it now if they're going to benefit from their demographic dividends. They need to have improving standards of governance today in order to rise to the challenges represented by technological innovation, because it is happening at an incredibly fast pace. And the good news is that high population countries that want to remain stable are doing just that. They are rising to the challenge overall, and that is particularly the case in China, which obviously has very large challenges, but also has a lot of innovative solutions and is really, I think, trying its very best to go from a middle-income country to a high-income country per capita. And industrial automation is a big part of that. Miniaturization is driving the Internet of Things. That creates enormous opportunity and enormous challenges. I suspect that cybersecurity is going to be a very important sector overall, but perhaps it is not one whose time has yet come. The price overall of the price of putting the solution in place is not yet beneficial enough to really be justified, because the cost of a breach is so low. I think that the cost of breaches is likely to increase, and that is something that could really drive the cybersecurity sector overall. But it is high technology and healthcare that are perhaps the real saviors of the global economy overall, because more than any other sectors, if we have energy, if we have energy, healthcare, and high technology all improving at an exponential rate, then productivity growth occurs, and it is productivity growth that helps to drive economic prosperity for the vast majority of people overall. And we have ample evidence of that from our history as a species. So there is great cause for optimism, and yet that doesn't mean that we are Pollyannish, but we do have to watch the consistency of trends, because the changing environment, and it is an environment that has been in place for a decade, it is changing, and that it is creating really quite attractive investment and trading opportunities over the short and medium term that we have to be aware of. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for the weekend. I'm running off to the airport, heading to London for the chart seminar next week, and it's going to be, I suspect it's going to be a good one, considering that we have delegates from a number of different countries and a number of different sectors. I suspect that there is going to be some very active discussions overall. So all the best to all of you.